This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, Nate. Good to be back.
Fantastic. Well, September's winding down. Fall is in the air. And so with that comes more questions.
All right.
As I wander around. Dear Dr. Lyle, why am I so stagnant? Despite doing poorly in practically all of the dimensions of my life, romantic, social, pursuit, I don't take any effective action. I've done an immense amount of therapies from various modalities, worked with many therapists, including numerous other things to no avail. I stew and I rage, but I don't do anything, and I don't know why. I also like to feel like a victim so as not to feel the pressure of responsibility. Any advice?
That's amazing. It's amazingly insightful. And yet the person sits if this is actually a true question. The answer to the dilemma is that all creatures always are running cost benefit analysis. And so the reason why a person takes action or doesn't take action or a specific course of action is cost benefit analysis. And so, as they say, apparently they're not doing well in any domain. But I'm immediately interested in the following observation, and that is that if they're not doing well in the domain of trade and commerce, why is it that they've got the resources to go to therapy? So it's like, how did that happen? And how is it that you are doing okay or well enough that you're not doing anything about this? And the answer is that the person's probably inherited money, trust fund child, or has some set of circumstances. Possibly they already have a maid of some kind that supports them. Money doesn't grow on trees. And so the resources to do what this that the person does are coming from somewhere. One of the main motivating factors for animals is hunger, starvation, predators, and cold. Okay. Discomfort drives productive activity. And so if the person has no discomfort per se, then somebody somewhere was productive and they're benefiting from it. Yeah. So that's the first question of Mr. or Ms. Stagnant. Is how is it that you have any resources at all, and is there any end to them in sight, and why are we so comfortable that we're sitting around going to psychotherapy, and yet we've got the resources to do that? Where did we get them from? Now, now in principle, you can feel pretty stagnant in areas of your life, despite having gone to therapy. So the person took action that was reasonable to go get information. The reason for change is new information. That is why people change, is that they have new information, and that new information, it may be that new information has said that what you have just been doing for the last 16 months in this project is, we just got one more day of data that says that it's not working. That's new information. You know, we're going to give this business one more try. We're trying to sell purple hot dogs, and we've done everything we can, and we've just spent, you know, our last $1,000 on some goofy internet ad and we expected it, you know, that it had a chance to work and now it didn't work. Okay, we got new information. And so now the new information is we consult our bank account and we now don't have any more money left. So now we have to make a change. So no matter what the circumstances are and what the changes that we're observing, the reason why people change behavior patterns is new information. So this person has then done a societally acceptable, reasonable strategy to get new information, which is to go to therapy. And apparently there's been a lot of complaining. So it turns out that there have been talking to therapists who probably have incorrect information on why it is that people struggle and have difficulties in life. And most therapists believe that, or I should say most, I believe that it is most, actually, in surveys, it's probably close to even between believing this or not believing this. But a great many therapists believe that the reason why people are having the struggles that they have today is because of traumatic events in their history. And so a great deal of therapy today is about going to therapy and processing, going back through and thinking through those traumatic events. And those traumatic events may have been, quote, a bad relationship with my father. Somehow this was traumatic. Or it could have been some actual real traumatic event, some event that took place that was very dangerous or very uncomfortable for the individual for a period of minutes or hours, or even repeatedly over a course of years. Who knows? But in any event, the notion is that the reason why the person has the ineffective behavior pattern that they have today is because they're responding to essentially damage or quasi-damage that has been done to them as a result of having had traumatic events. This is an incorrect analysis of the nature of trauma in human life and its outcomes. I don't just state this as a matter of opinion. I have a tremendous amount of empirical evidence to support this. But most therapists don't know about this evidence, and they've been incorrectly educated. And as a result, they are mistaken in their understanding of why people have the current struggles that they have. And so they, in honestly doing the best work that they know how to do, they lead the person down the memory path of trying to process traumatic events and thereby try to help them. And they're ineffective. It's not surprising that they're ineffective. This is looking for your heart problem in your past because you must have had a broken heart, okay? I have to tell you, this is very common. There's a great deal of commonality between psychodynamic thinking and New Age wackadoodle philosophy in natural medicine. So people are told that they have problems with their lungs because they can't get enough breath in because they're grieving. Okay, people are told that they have cancer because they've got bottled up anger. And the cancer is essentially poisoning themselves or some such thing. In other words, you can kind of hear the irritation in my voice. It's irritation because I've actually known and met practitioners that have doctorates, quote, and that they give this kind of feedback to patients. And to me, it's horrendously irresponsible, and it does far more harm than any kind of possible wacky good that could come out of such a bizarre explanations. And so the ideas are incorrect. And your lung problems, you know, whatever they are not as a result of repressed grieving. And your cancer is not the result of bottled up anger. What else have I heard? Oh, yeah, somebody was having trouble with their vision. And it was because, in theory, that there was things that they didn't want to see. All right. So I have a good friend of mine who's an ophthalmologist. If he ever heard this, he would want to hang whatever practitioner was saying this to a client, because like maybe they've got cataracts that I can remove and then we can take care of the problem, for God's sakes. Maybe they have diabetes as a result of their diet that's actually causing pressure on the system, and they're getting, you know, a pathological process that can be reversed. No, it's not psychogenic. So this individual sounds like they may have, if they've been complaining in therapy and talking about their victimhood, then we know what the flavor of that therapeutic process has looked like. Very likely well-meaning, totally misguided therapists, essentially participating in a dance that is of speculation about what the ultimate causes of the problem are, in a way that this is not going to work. This is working on a heart problem by talking about your broken heart. And it's not going to fly. We need to talk about your diet, and we need to do analysis of your cardiopulmonary function, and we need to figure out what's going wrong. We might need surgery, for God's sakes. We might need a pacemaker. We might just need a better diet. I'm not sure what we need, but what we sure as hell don't need is a psychological analysis of this. And so it sounds like it's quite possible they've gotten ineffective psychotherapy. Whether or not better, more accurate therapy would work. In other words, when a person comes in and we've got a cardiovascular problem that Caldwell Esselstyn knows absolutely exactly what to do to reverse it, and he can tell them what to do, but that doesn't mean they'll do it. Okay, remember, we're going to run into motivational problems with the pleasure trap, personality, intelligence, etc. And so it isn't necessarily the case that even though we know how to fix it, that the individual will take that opportunity. In the same way, if there's such a stagnant person that is stagnant came in to see Dr. Jen Hawk or myself, they would get an analysis of their competitive dilemma. And in that competitive dilemma, we would talk about the fundamentals, about what it is that they could likely do that would improve their competitive position. And we would also talk about the feeling that comes from working diligently at the fundamentals of the competitive problem. And we would explain how the mind map draws out how to generate self-esteem and how that this is the only way that self-esteem is generated, that it's through diligent, excellent effort, repeatedly administered to problems that are important to us, that our inner audience, our internal audience, observes our efforts repeatedly and then gives us a signal that we call self-esteem. Now, once a person has a correct understanding of how it is that their mind works and the control that they can exert with their own efforts towards changing their feeling experience, they may or may not do anything about it. Remember, what sits behind all of these cost-benefit analysis is personality. So a person that is inherently highly conscientious and emotionally stable and intelligent and etc., that individual is much more likely to take action that is logically related to positive outcomes than an individual that's lower in conscientiousness, far more impulsive and not as smart. Okay? So it isn't necessarily true. And none of those characteristics will either damn you or save you in isolation. There's all kinds of very smart people that are stagnant, and there's all kinds of not very smart people that are incredibly diligent and productive and would take a new idea once they were stagnant and see that it would be helpful for them and start working. So in no way is there anything in the personality cards that dictates success or failure. However, this is an interesting question, because it's one that it's the kind of question and from an individual that I would be always interested in exploring with them. This client is worth half an hour of my time, okay, or an hour. In other words, this is like, okay, let's make sure that you haven't overlooked your understanding of how your own mind works, and that you haven't overlooked the importance of earning your own self-esteem, and that you haven't also overlooked the importance of the fundamentals that would be associated with the statistical likelihood of increased success in the competitive arenas. If we are sitting around in dynamically oriented psychotherapy, blaming our parents or our traumatic history for our current inability to compete, then we're not going to be successful and we're not going to change direction, not very likely. But if you get sort of crisper, more accurate understanding of what the underlying causes are of the feeling and actions associated with the stagnation, then it's very possible that we can get this organism back on a more productive and happiness-generating direction as a result of improving its competitive standing with respect to the problems of life.
Wow. Yeah, it'd be interesting to be a fly on the wall in that scenario, because I know some people that they feel like they're stagnant. I mean, you look at them objectively and they're doing quite well, but mm-hmm. they can sometimes feel like they're stagnant and they're not, they don't feel like they can take effective action. Sometimes it's the ego trap and sometimes it's other mm-hmm. types of traps and, you know, who knows, but
yes,
but it's always fascinating to hear you walk through their people's minds, mm-hmm. with regards to these issues.
All right. What else we got?
All right. Dear Dr. Lyle, ever since I've been listening to the podcast, I'm now seeing the world in bell curves and spectrums. Thanks for that. mm-hmm. Your explanation of anger and guilt being mirror emotions really struck me. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's always a mirror emotion like anger and guilt? Or is it rather mostly a spectrum like your explanation of depression and then boredom when related to stress? I'd be curious to hear more about categorizing these emotions.
That's a good question. I haven't really quite thought about it. I didn't quite grasp that and map that in that way until they asked the question. I think I sort of intuitively have been aware of this. But yes, the fact that anger and guilt are so clearly the mirror image of each other, I think that it's likely that we're going to find that elsewhere. So, for example, I think we had a question with Jen the other night about lust and disgust or something like that. And so that would be an example of there being mirror images between finding someone extremely attractive and being lustfully drawn to them versus finding them repulsive and trying to push ourselves away. And so we can see that this is a sort of a bell curve with either end of it being, you know, the opposite reaction in terms of, essentially in terms of behavioral prescription and et cetera, and also approach avoidance strategy. So, yeah, let's think about that. You could think about being really excited and very happy versus being depressed. So that would be another example. And with boredom being... Boredom is a little difference that would be the difference between being bored and very interested. So those two would be on the opposite ends of that spectrum about how inherently interesting something is versus a judgment that it is completely uninteresting. And what's sitting underneath all of these feelings is obviously the cost-benefit analysis for gene survival. So intensive lust is saying that individual is extremely valuable for gene reproduction. My systems find that person extremely attractive and I want to mate with them in order to reproduce the DNA that built them. That's precisely what the chain of events is that's going on inside those cost-benefit algorithms. The boredom versus excitement or interest is going to be the i.e. extremely interested is, this looks like it's really valuable information that could increase my likelihood of gene survival through whatever increased likelihood of survival or reproductive success pathways, i.e., oh, you just showed me how somebody says that I can do something to really help my kid in this or that domain. That's a reproductive pathway. And so a parent might be extremely interested in that. Like, oh, my kid's got some... you know, struggling with some physical process, and it turns out that if they don't eat this or that food, that could be very important. Wait a minute, I'm really interested. Okay, versus boredom is the system saying, I don't see that there's any interesting information or any interesting possibilities here. These people, this place, this lecture, this book, I see nothing in it that is going to aid and abet my life experience. So I don't want any more of it. So you can see, I think the notion here is correct, that whenever you have a emotion of any kind, there should be a corresponding, in other words, that emotion is going to be either positive or negative, because the very reason why you have an emotion is it's a signal of gene survival importance. So it should be the case that emotion being either positive or negative, there is a mirror image emotion on the other side of it that is the opposite of what it is the other side of it is on the same with respect to the same evolutionary values. So, and it's going to have its corresponding specific signal to tell you about that. So yeah, I think we're all vaguely, I mean, certainly I've talked about this with respect to happiness and depression, but this, it is a nice question and a nice thing to help me clarify my own thinking and understanding of what how emotion would be structured. Yeah, it would, I believe that they would have logically interrelated polar opposites on any emotional dimension. I think that's correct.
And Dr. Lyle, can you go over again, a while back, maybe a couple dozen shows ago, mm-hmm. you talked about the stress related to motivation. And you said that, mm-hmm. And I can't remember all of it. You were saying that if you don't have any evidence that you might complete the task and you kind of feel not depressed, but you don't feel really motivated to complete it. Mm-hmm. But then you go through a little bit of stress, of a little bit of anxiety, and then you get this surge of motivation, and then
right.
and then once you're very, very competent at it, it's no longer difficult, then you feel bored.
Right.
Can you go over that kind of that spectrum again?
Yes. This is what I call the general mood model. So if you think about if you have an x-axis and you x and y-axis, and along the bottom end of the x-axis, we're going to put on the very close to the origin, we're going to put we're going to have a line that starts near the bottom left corner of near the origin, and it starts there, and it's going to go up at a 45 degree angle up to the right. And so if you think conceptually of this little 45 degree line segment, and on the lower left you put depression, and then up a little ways from there you put anxiety, and then in the middle of that line segment, you know, halfway up the line segment, we put stress, and then we put the next thing that we would put was that we would put excitement, and then finally we're going to put boredom at the top. Now, this has been my sort of observation about how the perceived probability of success is going to influence how it is that you feel. At very low, so perceived probability of success is going to be on the y-axis. So very low perceived probability of success is going to be depressing. We're going to infer that the value that's involved here is pretty important to the individual. So if the value is not very important, then all of the feelings or the intensity of the feelings are attenuated appropriately. So you're just not as upset or stressed about a broken shoelace as you are about, you know, whether or not you've got a problem closing the escrow of your dream home. So the depression is going to be low perceived probability of success. We're going to find that as your perceived probability of success rises a little bit, the characteristic feeling that we see in people is going to be less depression, and it's going to be more anxiety. So if we gave it numbers, it might make some sense to people. Suppose the perceived probability of success was 2%. if it's 2%, let's suppose you had the doc say, well, there's a 2% chance that we can remove this thing and cure your cancer. It's like, wow, that's pretty depressing. It means it's very likely that they can't do it. Okay? If they come to you and they say, well, there's a 15% chance, now you're not as depressed. It's more anxiety. It's like, oh my God, there's a really good chance I'm going to die, but I might not. I got a chance. So you can feel anxiety coming up with a low perceived probability of success, but there is still a significant perceived probability of success. You can imagine that if you're feeling tense like that, let's say it's 25. I mean, pick a number. But if you're like, oh my God, you know, I hope that this works. I hope it works. And then they come with a new lab report and they say, actually, it's 2%. Devastating. Okay? Depressing. It's like I'm defeated. So now they come with a lab report and they say, actually, it looks like it's more like 50-50. Okay? You can actually feel a little difference there. From the 25 to the 50, it's like, okay, I'm really stressed. I'm stressed about this. And you could call some of it anxiety, but anxiety often has a feeling of dread that it looks like it's not, you know, it's not going to work. Okay, so now we've improved it a little bit to where it's like, you know what? I think, God, I could really win this thing. I could also lose it, but I could win it. And so that's a high state of high tension. But it's characterologically somewhat different than the dread feeling that often comes with anxiety. Now we're going to move it up to the new lab report comes and says, you know what, we send it to a new lab that can actually see clearly more through the molecular structure of the tumor. We didn't have this technology even 6 months ago. Now it looks like there's a 95% chance that you're going to be fine. Tremendous excitement. Okay. It's like, oh my God, what a tremendous relief. How exciting. Oh my God. Let me see those results again. Are you sure? Etc. Okay. So now that this is, you know, happiness. So you can track all this with a guy, you know, flirting with some girl in the, you know, for the ninth grade prom. He's thinking about asking her out. It looks like she kind of insulted him today a little bit in class, just as he was thinking about asking her out. And now what does he feel? Depression. What was he feeling when he was thinking about it, but he hadn't been insulted by her yet? Anxiety. He was thinking he probably wasn't going to be successful, but he was maybe going to ask anyway. Okay. What if she gave him some pretty decent feedback? But it wasn't super warm, but it was at least something, and it seemed like she was treating him just as well as any of the other kids, maybe a little bit better. Stressed as he's walking up to her, okay? What if she smiles and is slightly flirtatious with him and gets playful with him? Now what does he feel? Excitement, okay? What if it's his girlfriend? And they're already well established, and she fully expects him to ask her out for the thing, and it's actually already, you know, done. But now he actually has to say, "Hey, you know, we're going to the junior prom, right?" You know, how much excitement is that? Huh? It's just his mom told him, "Don't forget to tell Sally you're taking her to the junior prom." Mm-hmm. It's like, "Oh yeah, mom, that's right. Okay, that's right. I forgot. I need to tell her that." I.e., boredom. It's not reviewing on his radar. There's no feeling of threat, etc. So this is the what I call the general mood model. It's not the specific feelings that we would have. The specificity comes with the domain involved. So we can see that we shifted domains between a person's survival and a person's reproduction. You know, at very different points in their lives. And we can see that the feelings have a general character to them, but the specificity comes with the specificity of the domain that's in question. So this is a helpful way to understand, for example, our person that we were talking about that's stagnant. Essentially what's happening is that they are effectively bored. the information that they're getting is not telling them that it's any new information isn't changing their perceived probability of success. There's a little bit of a defeatist way of thinking here. In other words, they're somewhat depressed. They feel like they can't do better in that domain. So what's the point of trying? And so there's an energy conservation prescription that comes with depression that will also come with boredom. So it's like, hey, I already know how to do this. It's not, I can't put a lot of energy into it. Who cares? I'm not too interested. Think about a great free thrower in basketball that is so good at this that now the coach blows his whistle and says, time to work on your free throws. And it's like, really? I don't need to be working on my free throws. Surely there's something else that I could do that would be more valuable for my time. So meanwhile, there's another person that's very depressed because they've been working on their free throws and they just can't seem to improve. And they feel very uncompetitive in this arena and they just want to avoid the whole thing. So you can see that those two feelings they're interrelated to or to each other in a way, but they have a different emotional tone or character that's a slightly different signal.
Now, do you think that basketball players may feel this emotion if they, say, win the free throw contest at their local adult basketball camp? For our listeners who don't know, Dr. Lyle won the free throw. He set a record at an adult basketball camp.
Oh, all right. All good. Very exciting.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm a bit confused about when disagreeableness is seen as a negative and positive trait.
Mm-hmm.
You've said that agreeableness is a highly valued trait.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's clear that one would want a disagreeable lawyer,
mm-hmm.
you also said that charisma basically comes down to disagreeableness. And when most people think of charismatic people, they certainly don't think of pushiness and anger. I'm mm-hmm. probably 70th percentile disagreeable, but pretty mm-hmm. stable, and generally try to beat my genes by hiding it, but not contradicting people, avoiding confrontation, for example, with groups of friends. Mm-hmm. Am I right to do so, or could I win more friends and esteem by being more, quote, assertive?
I don't know. This is one of these funny little dilemmas of how to best maneuver around your own knowledge of your own personality for your own best interests. And I think these are complex matrices that are shifting with every situation. So I don't think that blanket prescriptions are going to do a lot of good. Certainly, I think charisma has something to do with disagreeableness because we're talking about winning some competitive process very often. It might not necessarily, depends on what we mean by charisma. In other words, we have to get out a dictionary and start giving ourselves other adjectives and find out if we're all talking about the same thing. But a great deal of what has been known as charisma is essentially dominance, a sense that the individual is superior in some way. And in order to get to that position, and obviously a great deal of charisma is just sheer sexual attractiveness. So, imagine Brad Pitt playing a part where he was very agreeable and non-assertive and compliant. Okay, suddenly the quote charisma is evaporating before our very eyes. A big point of it is the sort of message of superiority and having some force behind it and some willingness to push for dominance in some kind of a decision-making or display arena. So for this person's question, I think it sounds like they've got enough conscientiousness and enough stability that they understand that when they are contradicting people among friends, that this is going to be prickly and it's going to make them less attractive, a less attractive member of the group, and therefore valued less. And so they're realizing, hey, this is a potential expense. And so they've got, you know, a complicated brain that is wrapping around this thing and realizing that they don't want to get kicked out of the coalition, or they don't want to have their evaluation of their value to the coalition be reduced by displaying some of the disagreeableness that's in there. Now, I think all of us certainly have this. If we're highly disagreeable or even highly agreeable, we have we're monitoring how often that we want to correct or point out or object, et cetera, to the agenda or the opinions of people around us. And we have to adjudicate in our own mind what's in our best interest in total with respect to this. And so I don't think that this is unique to a disagreeable person, but I think a disagreeable person is probably a disagreeable, stable, intelligent, and conscientious individual is probably got a lot of action in that brain working inhibitory, you know, structures to try to stop some of these objections and contradictions from arising out of their vocal cords. And so, yeah, they're probably aware of some turbulence in that way. My good friend, Dr. Alan Goldhammer, is inherently quite disagreeable. And so we've had many discussions about what it's like to be inside his mind. And it's interesting because his internal experience is different than mine. So if there's a waitress that comes to our table and we start to explain what we're going to do, Alan is very sensitive to the woman's annoyance with respect to all the careful prescriptions about how we want things differently. And he feels this irritation. I feel it at a much lower level than he does. And I also feel empathy for her frustration that this is going to be a lot more cognitive energy than she was expecting to have to put up with for this. And therefore, I actually feel some empathy for her. Alan doesn't. Okay. And
so that's the disagreeable chip. I assumed it was the like a high open because I feel that I feel similarly sensitive when that those situations come up. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So in other words, I see both
Although
sides
I might
of it.
Tip more afterwards.
No, the great thing is Alan will tip 15% and then he'll say, they like me here because I'm a good tipper. So anyway, I have to bite my lip. He's not the only friend I have like that. I have another friend that tips so little that I have to circle back and put extra money on the table to have not my reputation damaged when he's paying the bill. So he won't listen to this podcast, so he won't know that happens from time to time. So you can see that all of us are locked into this is why human social behavior and optimizing your behavior is complicated. And what you have is you don't have essentially a seamlessly integrated personality. Your personality is built of, you know, half a dozen vectors. And so this is a vector analytic problem that the brain is solving as it solves similar types of problems with respect to cost-benefit analysis in any domain that has any richness to the CB problem, which is most problems are fairly complicated for the human mind to solve, but it does it seamlessly. In the same way, though, there's going to be situations that are going to come up, and your disagreeable people are having a lot of action in there saying, this is ridiculous, they're wrong, this is ridiculous, they're wrong, they're lazy, they're shortchanging me, they should do a better job, etc. They're having this sort of internal negative, objecting, judgmental dialogue. They don't know any different. It's just the way they are. And they're not uncomfortable the way I am. If I'm in that state, I'm pretty angry and I'm pretty upset. It's an unusual state, and I feel like the individual is significantly out of line relative to the norms, and so that's why I'm upset. But to a person that's more inherently disagreeable, this is sort of situation normal, that they're sort of a very disagreeable person is sort of chronically feeling like the world is cheating or chiseling or somewhat unfair, and that they need to be vigilant and they need to be looking out to make sure to assert their fair interests, because otherwise they're going to be chiseled and cheated. And that's a, you know, that's just sort of, it's not a particularly uncomfortable place for them to be. That's just where they are.
It gives you something to do all day long, right?
Yeah,
I've often believed that perhaps this is maybe more disagreeable people maybe potentially could be more ambitious because they they don't feel like it's fair unless they've accomplished a lot more, and so therefore the only way they're going to accomplish it is through through all these things. So
yes, I think that that's true, and I think that the disagreeable dimension adds a push to feeling like the existing circumstances are not as they should be. And et cetera. So I think that particularly wedded to conscientiousness, I think that's a particularly effective combination for high achievement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, high achievement is. And so would you expect that someone who's more disagreeable and more conscientious may also be more likely to fall into the various traps that you've talked about, potentially ego trap? Because their expectations of themselves may be quite high versus someone who's more agreeable. I'm not sure.
I'm not so sure about that. I wouldn't necessarily guess that. In other words, they're not thinking that the other people think more highly of them, and they're also thinking that the deck is stacked against them unfairly.
So
as a result, I think it's more likely to drive a determined achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And so, no, I don't believe that they would be more likely to be in the ego trap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, something I've thought about before is when we talk about, and this has been a question in our show, somebody sent it to me, and I'm just waiting for the right time. This just happens to be it, is when you've got someone who's highly disagreeable, but let's say they're not very conscientious, can their competitive drive cause them to, or result in them being actually very fastidious in achieving a particular goal, even though they may not be very conscientious personality wise?
Let's back up for a second, and as we start to try to, we can dig ourselves into a position that we don't quite want to be in when it comes to this kind of analysis. So I don't want to talk out of both sides of my mouth, but I want to be a little clearer about this. What you have are genes that are influencing how it is that you feel, and so we've characterized these things, I think, in a useful way with the words that we use, like conscientious, intelligent, stable, etc. But what these things are is these are gross approximations of the way we describe individual differences between people. So when we say Susie's more conscientious than Sarah, that means that over 1,000 situations, it's more likely that Susie makes the conscientious investment process, and it's more likely that, you know, if she does 774 of them, it's likely that Sarah does less. Okay? But in any given situation, we're not going to be able to predict it, and these are all that's because those 1,000 situations, if we give them all essentially identical, close enough to identical sets of situations across a lot of different CB combinations, we're going to find on average Susie's more conscientious than Sarah. But the problem is that. That there isn't sort of one ingredient in there or a gene that we're talking about is conscientiousness. It's a whole, that's a description of an individual difference that is global and diffuse and multifaceted like crazy. So I just came up with an example. It's like saying Judy is more beautiful than Susie. It's like, yeah, except that Susie does have better legs, okay? And Susie has better lips and her nose is a little better. But on average, most people would agree, okay? but we could go feature by feature and we would see a lot of features where that wasn't true. And so we're using some global overall thing that we call beauty, and even some people might even disagree. Okay? So we use a word to describe a whole bunch of different things, and those whole bunch of different things are actually independent of each other. So the legs are independent of the nose. Okay? But taken together, we have a global thing that we're calling beauty, and we're putting the global number on it. That's the same thing as true with conscientiousness or intelligence or anything else. So it isn't like we have a specific thing called that person's a 9, and therefore their nose is a 9, their breasts are a 9, their legs are a 9, their hair is a 9, their eyes are a 9. No, that isn't what it is. They're a montage of a bunch of different things that we're paying attention to. And so as a result, there's an overall impression of their attractiveness. And the same thing would be true with conscientiousness or anything else. So that's why you can have a person who's really smart, like Dr. Goldhammer, but he has no sense of direction. Okay, so there's 3-year-old children, autistic, that have better sense of direction than Alan does.
Which is fascinating because he has a True North Health Center, which is the compass for going in the right direction with regards to health. What a paradox.
Yeah, absolutely. You got it. That's beautiful. So that's in answer to your sort of question or musing, it's not so easy to say, you know, we could sort of talk in broad terms and probably pull out and hypothesize about dynamics. And then it would be interesting in certain cases to see if we could find a set of situations where we could look at those predictions out of our hypothesized dynamics and see if we've got some truth in it. But it's never going to be the case that we could even say that somebody who's judged as a 10 has, I don't know, prettier feet than someone who's a 2. That might not be the case. In other words, they may, in an individual situation, it could absolutely be the case that someone who's very low in conscientiousness does a better job on some specific aspect of what we might be considering conscientiousness to be a major variable, but they happen to do a better job on that than our person who's extremely conscientious. And so that's why it's not so easy to make highly specified predictions about these dynamics. It's easier to be more general about them and to talk in terms of likely probabilities. And that's, i.e. someone with a very high credit rating is unlikely to default on your loan, and someone with a much lower credit rating is much more likely, but circumstances are circumstances, and that may not be how it goes down.
Fascinating. Yeah, my example, like what I was thinking in my head asking mm-hmm. that question is, it may be a bullshit example, but it's no. The Hollywood trope of, the psychopath serial killer, but you see him on the movie and they're displaying quite OCD type of behaviors. So that's where yes. that question came from. So
yeah, and I think that's where that's really good. Yeah, and that points out a problem with the concept of conscientiousness. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a very big word that encompasses, maybe too much. And so the fact that it runs correlations against suites of genes pretty well doesn't tell us that we can simplify it down that easily. I.e. Hitler was extremely conscientious. And yet, what do we mean by that?
Right. The moral compass would be different.
Right.
Than, okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's where this gets, problematic in communication and therefore prediction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. So I guess if we add that a little more. Okay. Okay. Well, all right, doctor, our last question.
All right.
So our previous question is about potentially trying to be too disagreeable or trying to be more disagreeable.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm trying to work on this, but I feel like I have an issue with agreeableness. I'm too agreeable to the point that I feel bad about myself for disappointing others, like turning down a job offer or rejecting a potential partner when it's obvious that those situations won't work out? Mm-hmm. How do I get past this trying to please all of the people all the time mentality?
You'll probably never get past the mentality because that's the person's personality. However, you may become more skilled at figuring out how you're going to give these people rejecting messages. So that's a different issue. So that such a question, for example, posed to my friend Alan, who I'm picking on today, exposing his psychology to the world, like Alan would just shake his head from side to side in wonderment about why such a thing would be difficult, because it wouldn't be difficult for him to give the people negative feedback. It'd be like, hey, this is how it is. Sorry, it may be inconvenient for you, but I can't come to work for you. Done. And so the other side of the equation is the, far more mirror neurons, far more agreeable, and therefore a lot of empathy, soaking its way through the system, making it very difficult to give negative feedback. You're not going to change this any more than you're going to change any of us in terms of our basic personality. What you can do, though, is you can very narrowly get better at preparing for those kinds of situations and literally, essentially writing dialogue and having some rehearsals in your own mind, or actually, against the wall or to a friend. This is how it is that we can get through some of these stressful situations. Very often, these stressful situations, which involve us rejecting other people, are very, very narrow and time limited. So if you look at in the romance arena, for example, sometimes the communication of rejection or acceptance is a momentous little event that has to do with one sentence that the people said. And they can remember that sentence 16 years later. Okay. It's like, yeah, we were talking on the phone and I said this and then she said that. And then I knew that was that. There's no point in pursuing that. And it wasn't said by accident. In other words, these are sort of momentous moments in people's lives where the other person exposes where their judgment is really at and what's going to happen. What was I going to say? So the point is that very often we don't have to say a lot, but we may be giving our rejecting message and it may be very short, but we may want to essentially find a way to say this that it is as palatable as possible and is displaying, essentially who it is that we are, our friendliness and agreeableness, while we still make a stand and make it clear that this is how this is going to have to go. So this is, I've got on my website, a whole bunch of these little audios, and some of those audios have to do with those kinds of issues. I think, for example, Crazy Girlfriend, Crazy Boyfriend gives an example of how it is that we do things. Flood the Circuit is also another concept. Blaming Big Louie, this is another concept. There's ways that we can give negative feedback to people that if we orchestrate it carefully, we can do this in a way that's extremely diplomatic. And that's a good way to go for someone who is inherently very agreeable. You sometimes need to prepare for these relatively large moments in life. Now, if we're talking about what you're going to say to your friends, that very often they say, hey, let's all go to such and such for dinner, and you get swept up in that and you don't want to do it, I think that's going to be very difficult to change. So you may have a little bit of success here and there, but probably you're going to continue to get swept up by your friends in that kind of a situation, because that's a repetitive thing that's arising naturally in your social ecological circumstances, and you're not going to change your personality. But with respect to relatively more important things like rejecting potential mates and rejecting, other things of significant social offerings, those things sometimes require that we exercise diligence in preparing for how it is that we're going to say those things so that we can get them said. I have to tell you that the modern world has actually given us a beautiful tool for the agreeable person called email. Okay? So I have told many agreeable people that they can break up with people over email, and they can tell their mother-in-law they're not coming for Thanksgiving over email. And you can just, it's way easier to do it remotely than it is in person. And there's no reason why you have to stand up there in person and tell the guy that you're not going to see him again, and that these are the reasons why, and you really think he's great, and blah, blah, blah. You don't have to subject yourself to the social pressure that's very likely to be on the other side of that. You can use a email or remote kind of communication where we flood the circuit nicely, just according to design, say pleasant things, and then blame Big Louie, i.e., I've just got things going on with myself, and this just won't work, or, you know, I'd really love to work for your company, but it turns out that my circumstances have shifted a little bit, and now it's just not going to work out, but thank you so much, okay? So we don't have to actually put up with the cross-examination where very agreeable people get themselves into trouble, okay? We can blame Big Louie, flood the circuit, deal with the crazies, and get out. And that's a very useful mechanism for doing so.
That's wonderful. I read a story about a software engineer who passed away, and then they found all kinds of things on his computer that mm-hmm. were doing exactly that. It's a pretty agreeable personality from what I read. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he set up is he wrote a little program that he had one guy that he didn't really like in the office. And every time the guy would email him, he had an automated email that would just go out saying, no worries, no problem, and then just reset his server. And so that way he didn't have to communicate with him at all. And it,
right. That's great.
There's a guy beating his jeans.
You got it.
All right, Dr. Right. Lyle. Well, thank you so much for these wonderful, wonderful questions and answers, Dr. Lyle. We're really looking forward to talking with you again next week.
All right, Nathan.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.